The Hoop Heads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The game of basketball, this is just a small piece of the pie. This is just a small piece of the big picture. And, you know, like I said, me as a basketball coach, I try to use the game to teach these guys about life after the game. And for most of them, life once high school is done, because most of them won't end up playing in college or beyond. So I just try to utilize basketball to help teach these kids about life.
Coach Brian Swift is the boys' head coach and athletic director at Warrensville Heights High School in Ohio. Brian won a state championship as a high school sophomore at Chanel and finished as the state runner-up during his senior year at Warrensville Heights. Brian went on to play Division I college basketball for the University of South Florida, where he enjoyed an outstanding career competing for the Bulls in Conference USA. After college, Coach Swift played professional basketball for 5 seasons, 4 in France and 1 in Finland. He learned a lot about himself during his time overseas, and that experience continues to impact his coaching today. To begin his coaching career, Brian Swift returned to his hometown of Warrensville Heights as the head coach of the Tigers, and then added the athletic director title after earning his master's degree from Ohio University. Brian has a tremendous desire to impact the student athletes in his community as both a basketball coach and as an athletic director. Make sure you take some notes as you enjoy this conversation with Coach Brian Swift from Warrensville Heights High School in the state of Ohio.
Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And today we are here with Coach Brian Swift. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We are very glad to have you with us tonight. Brian, we're going to start out by asking you how you got into the game of basketball when you were a kid.
I got in early. My parents probably put the ball in my hand, I would say, probably 3 or 4 years old. But it was easy because I had an older brother and older sister who was kind of already playing sports at that time, especially my brother. He's about 8 years older than me. So with him kind of being involved with it, I took a liking to it. So, you know, that young, I had a basketball hoop in my backyard. So a lot of the older kids, my brother's age, they would be playing. And, you know, being young, I just want to get out there and play. Those guys will be pushing me off the court and doing things like that. Get out the way. So, you know, from a young age, I really took a liking to it. And I just, it stuck with me, you know what I mean, all the way through middle school, high school, college, professionally to now. You know, even though I'm not playing but coaching, but I'm still around it.
And so when you were a kid, did you play other sports too besides basketball, or were you all hoops right from the beginning?
It's crazy. Basketball was not the first sport that I played. Actually, wrestling was the very first sport. Wrestling was the very first sport my parents signed me up for. After that, I think baseball was the next sport that I played. And that came about because a friend of our family had kids as well that were about my age, and they were playing baseball. So my parents, you know, they asked my parents, hey, you know, does Brian want to play baseball? They signed me up. I did that for about 2 to 3 years, and I think after my second year of baseball, that kind of segued into like a rec league basketball in Shaker. Okay. And that's kind of how I started playing basketball, like I said, after wrestling and baseball.
That's kind of an unusual background, because usually I know we think of you know, basketball players, sometimes you get the basketball football combo. You rarely get the wrestling basketball combo.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy how it worked out. And then Warrensville, growing up in Warrensville, like when I was young, we really didn't have like basketball leagues for kids. You know, we had a summer basketball camp that we all grew up playing in. That was like an 8-week camp in the summer. I think I started doing that about fourth grade. But before that, we really didn't have anything. So like I said, my parents, a friend of theirs, they lived in Shaker. So, you know, they had a rec league in Shaker. He asked, you know, if I could play, and I started playing there. So when I got into basketball, like my first 3 years, I was actually playing a part of Shaker's youth basketball program.
So when you were coming up, I know because I'm a little bit older than you, but when I was coming up, the AAU system that's kind of in place now really wasn't around. So when I was playing, it was like there was two teams in Cleveland. There was a West Side team and there was an East Side team, and that was pretty much it. So when you were coming up, when you got to middle school and you started taking the game more seriously, what did summer basketball look like for you?
In comparison to now, we didn't play as much AAU. You didn't have as many tournaments. You didn't have as many teams. So a lot of the times, like, we were still out in the street playing basketball in our backyards, at the park, doing things like that. It wasn't every weekend and, you know, week in and week out, we were having tournaments. So, I mean, that was, I think, the major difference from now. But, I mean, it was still, you know, it was competitive. Basketball was fun. We traveled. We did different things like that. So, like I said, you just don't have the amount of teams and players that were playing at that time.
So what's your opinion on AAU from a playing standpoint and now also from a coaching standpoint? So if you look at the system that you came up under, where you weren't maybe necessarily playing every weekend on an AAU game, but you were playing at the playground and playing with your friends, versus now where everybody's playing every weekend, everybody's got a coach, there's, you know, you're always playing with an official. How do you look at that from a player standpoint? Like, if you were coming up in the game today, would you like it more or less than the way you did it? And then also, as a coach, obviously, your players are, you know, impacted by the system as they come through it now.
I think it's hard to say. I think, you know, you only know what you know. Right. So I think if you come up in this era, I mean, obviously you'll like it because if you love basketball, you play all the time. But, you know, growing up when I did, I think different aspects, you know, of the game helped me develop. Like, not playing, you know, under the whistle every single weekend and organize as much probably helped me develop as a player rather than, you know, playing every weekend in a tournament, playing 3-4 games a day for 6 months out of the year. You know what I mean? Overall, I think AAU in its entirety, I think it's a good thing because I think it gives kids an opportunity, you know, for exposure, to get positive exposure, for coaches to see you, for scouts to see you, things like that. But I think, and I talk about this to my friends all the time, but I think it can also act in a negative light because sometimes exposure could be a bad thing for people. Because I think sometimes when you play too much and you're seen too much, you know, you get picked apart a little bit more. And you know, it's not as structured, I would say, as probably coaching, you know, and playing high school basketball. You know, we probably are a little more demanding. We have a lot more time to coach our kids and practice and things like that as well. But I just think a lot of those bad habits go overlooked by some AAU coaches. I can't say all, but some coaches kind of go overlooked. And those bad habits tend to trickle over into high school basketball, and coaches kind of, you know, pull their hair out every year thinking, oh man, I got to get rid of these things, you know, because they aren't really picked upon during the off season, you know. But again, I think, like I said, I think it's a good thing just because of the exposure aspect of it.
Yeah, and I think too, tell me if I'm thinking the same way that you are. I think one of the things that we've talked about with some other coaches is that kids today, there's a depth in terms of the amount of kids that have a wider range of skills maybe than if you go back 15 or 20 years where, you know, you might have had guy 10, 11, 12 on your varsity team that wasn't tremendously skilled, whereas now there's lots of kids that can handle the ball and do things. Doesn't necessarily mean they're better players, but I think there's a better depth of skill just because of the exposure to coaches and games and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, like I said, with the implementation of YouTube and social media and all these different things, the information is more available. You know what I mean? If you look around just Northeast Ohio, you probably have 100 basketball trainers within a 20.
100? I think you're underestimating, bro.
Yeah, I guess I'm being generous. So, but then, you know, you get my point. It's so many trainers. You can go to any gym and you can find some type of basketball training going on. So I think, like I said, when we were coming out, you didn't have that. I didn't have a basketball trainer. I didn't have a shooting coach. I didn't have a athletic trainer to teach me how to get faster, how to jump higher. I didn't have all those things. So the depth of talent and skill sets are definitely, I think, more than in the past. But I think it has a lot to do with all those things that I named.
So how do you feel about, as a high school coach, do you build relationships or do you have to build relationships or does anybody try to build relationships with you in terms of guys who are maybe working with your players, whether it's an AAU coach, whether it's a trainer, it's somebody that's not you? Do you build relationships with those guys or is that something that's difficult to do or do you find that happens a lot, doesn't happen? What's your take on that?
No, I mean, I think I have, since playing, and a lot of guys that do train now were you know, players in the past, so I'm familiar with a lot of the trainers. Not everyone, but I think relationships to me are very important anyway. And I think, you know, any trainer can give a lot to a player. You know, some trainers probably have a little bit more playing experience than others, but some trainers like myself, I trained actually before I got into coaching. But, you know, I think it just depends on, you know, what trainers focus on. Some trainers focus on ball handling. Some focus on shooting. So I think it depends on the particular trainer. But I have a pretty good relationship with a lot of those guys. I'm not really one of those guys that, you know, if I train a kid or one of my players are training with another trainer, I take it personally, or I'm going to talk bad about that trainer. Like, because I look at it like this: none of these kids are my kids personally, you know. So we're all here to help these kids regardless of who trained the kid the most or anything like that. So I try to stay out of those things, and I try to keep a, you know, just a positive outlook on anybody training with any trainer that's in this area.
Yeah, I think anytime you can give and build relationships with, you know, with the guys that are working with your players, I think that helps. And I think it also, you know, a lot of times, you know, like I know you're describing the fact that there is some territorial situations where people kind of get, this is my guy, this is my coach, this is my player, whatever.
Right.
And I think we're all better off in the basketball world if everybody just can figure out a way to work together. Again, for the benefit, if you circle back to, it's for the benefit of the kids, I think we're all better off. And I think that's what I hear you saying.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, because again, when I graduated college and I, you know, I played professionally and I came back home, my number one thing was I wanted to try to help as many kids as I possibly could get to the level I got to and beyond the level I got to, because again, having a personal trainer wasn't something that we were used to. So I saw, just being around and being exposed to different things, this is what's going on throughout the country. And not saying there weren't any during that time, like as I was in college or playing professionally here in Cleveland, but it wasn't an abundance of training going on. So I figured, like, I can come in, my name is pretty fresh still being a player here in Cleveland and things like that, that I can make an impact in that matter, regardless of what school they went to, who was they coaching, anything like that. It was solely about the kids. So that's why even on social media, like, you don't see me boasting or doing anything about that, about what kids I train, what school. It doesn't matter to me. As long as the kid is successful, that's all I care about.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to approach it. And that's one of the things that I know that for me, myself, and, you know, I do some training and have camps and that kind of thing. And I don't post on social media in terms of, you know, pictures of me with kids and that kind of thing, because it still comes down to, just like you said, ultimately you want it to be about the kid and not about you. And I think when you start putting your arm around every person that you talk to and that you work with, I think sometimes then we kind of shift our focus and it becomes more about the coach or the trainer as opposed to being about the kids and really helping to make them, you know, help them get better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's go back to talk about your high school career. Can you point to one or two things that stand out to you? Maybe it was, you know, a moment that stands out to you, something that you learned from one of your coaches. Just go back and kind of walk us down memory lane with some of the things that you remember from your high school career.
Honestly, the one thing that stands out to me, I mean, from the start, I think it's the state championship. 1999 Chanel High School state championship. That was it for me. I mean, that was the best moment, because I'm all about winning. And winning the state championship is something that no one ever could take away. It's still in the record books, in the OHSA books. 1999, you'll see Chanel High School. So, and we were an undefeated team as well. So that's something that stands out, and that's in the history here in Ohio. So I think that's the main thing. But obviously, like I said, I went to Chanel High School from 98 to 2000. Played there before transferring to Warrensville, where I grew up in Warrensville. And graduating actually my senior year, I went back to Columbus. We lost in the state championship game to Kettering Alter, who had about three or four Division I players in their starting lineup. They were a very good team. I think their big man went to Florida State, Adam Weliskowski, if I can remember correctly. Very good team, and we end up losing that game. I think those two moments kind of stood out to me, because I think the goal that we had coming into the season, one, we solidified the goal, and the next one, you know, we came up a little short. So I think those two were the biggest thing. The individual goals, I had a lot of individual accolades, you know, Player of the Year, Division III, my sophomore year, three-time best of the best in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Player of the Week every season, two-time All-State. Just different accolades, MVP of the leagues and things like that, you know. But for me, the championships and winning was more important than the individual things.
So how much does that loss in the state championship game, how much does that hang with you even today?
I mean, it hangs a lot. It hangs a lot. I mean, if you ask any of my guys now as a coach, you know, I go into every single season with one goal in mind, and that's winning the state championship. You know, and I think, like I said, the year before I came back, Warrensville had won a state championship, and then we lost the year I came back. So, you know, I would like to kind of avenge the loss, if you will, you know, especially with a Warrensville, you know, under my, you know, my the school that I graduate from, this community I'm from. So I think that's one thing that kind of drives me to try to get back down there and win one.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've talked to a bunch of different people about is the idea of whether you – hate to lose more or love to win more. And if you had to go back and think about yourself, which one of those, if you had to pick one of those two, which one would you describe yourself as? Do you hate to lose more or do you love to win more?
Yeah, I probably hate to lose more because, like, for me, and I'll kind of explain why. Like, throughout my playing career from AAU to middle school to high school, all these different things, I was one of those guys who, you know, we won a lot. You know, I won a lot of games, you know, at different levels. So to lose, it's like, oh my God, like, what is this? I don't like this feeling. Yes, you remember those moments a lot more, you know what I mean? Because it's just one of those things you just don't want to go through. You know what I mean? So I think I hate to lose guy more than loving to win.
Do you think, here's a question that I kind of ask myself a lot. Do you think that the kids coming up through the current system today, do you think they feel the same level of distaste for losing that you did, that I do, where by playing on the playground and you lose a game and you got to sit for 2 hours while you wait to get back onto the court, and now when you know in the AAU system, you know, you play 3 or 4 games, 5 games a weekend, you lose one, and you know the next game is coming, you know, 2 hours later. Do you think that there's the same level of, do you see that as a coach that kids burn with that same hatred of losing that maybe players in our era had, or do you think there's not much difference?
I think for me, it's funny because I get on my guys now about that a lot. You know, we have open gym at the school and, you know, you see some of your better players, you know, when they lose games, you know, they're not that bothered.
Right.
You know, so I get on them a lot. That bothers me, you know, because I know when I'm one of the best guys, again, like you said, I'm used to if I go to the park or the gym and it's open gym and you lose, you got to sit 3, 4, 5 games. Mm. And, you know, some people just put their shoes on and go home. Like, man, I'm not waiting to play again after 30, 45 minutes, you know. But now these kids are so used to, like I said, with AU, every weekend playing 3 or 4 or 5 games in a weekend, you lose, you know I have another game. If I lose this tournament, I know I'm going to play next week. I lose this one, I know I'm going to play that weekend. So it really never gets to settle in. And it's like, it's almost like it's not that big of a deal. You know what I mean? It's not that big of a deal to them. And I tell them, listen, that's a mentality that you don't cut on and off. That's a mentality that you have in general. So if you feel like now that it's not a big deal that you lose, you're not really going to go into the game when it counts and feel like, man, I have to do what I have to do now because it means everything to me. No, if we lose, oh, well, we lost. See you on Friday. You know what I mean? That's just a mentality that, you know, I can't really understand because, you know, that's not one I have, but I see it far too often nowadays.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really difficult as a former player, especially a player who is as competitive as you were, that as a coach, when you see your players that don't burn with that same intensity, I know one of the things that I always found to be frustrating as a coach was, you know, if you're doing a drill, let's say two kids are, you know, playing one-on-one or it's a two-on-two at both ends and winners stay on one side, whatever, and kids would lose and they just you know, like to your point, they would just kind of shrug their shoulders and move to wherever they were supposed to move to next. And you just didn't see that, you know, they're mad. They're upset that they lost. It's just kind of like, eh, we'll move on to the next thing and tell me what you want me to do next. I know as a coach, that was one of the things that I always found to be the most difficult to deal with, was just that mentality of that every single moment, every single competition meant something to me. And I always wanted it to mean more to my players than sometimes it did to them.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's one of those things. It's like, you know, just things you say to coaches, I can't go out and play for you. I can't give you my heart. I can't give you my brain. Things like that. It just has to be in you. You know, you just have to want it a little more. And it's like, as a coach, it's frustrating, but you can't want it more than the kids.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And if you do, your team probably isn't going to be is not going to be very successful.
Nah, not at all.
As much as your players.
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
So talk a little bit about, you finish up at Warrensville, and talk a little bit about your recruiting process and how you ended up at the University of South Florida. Talk a little bit about what that process looked like for you. Maybe some advice that you'd have for kids. Now you've seen it on the coaching side of it too, in terms of the recruiting process. So talk a little bit about how that went for you when you were coming out of high school.
I mean, the recruiting process, it was fun. I can say that as a kid, 16-year-old kid, beginning to, you know, get letters at your school every day, letters at home and things like that. I mean, it's definitely a fun process because you feel good. You feel as though, you know, the hard work and the success you're having, you know, is being recognized. So, I mean, it's definitely a fun process. You know, I had a lot of the Ohio schools that, you know, were recruiting me. Pretty much every school in Ohio pretty much recruited me. Had some out of state. Wisconsin recruited me. Marquette recruited me. UNC Charlotte recruited me. A lot, like I said, a lot of schools throughout the country recruited me. Going into my senior year, I think I shaved it down to like my last five schools. And ultimately, and I'll put this out now because I'm old, Cincinnati was my number one choice. That's really where I wanted to go. Bob Huggins, if you listen, I wanted to play for you, but it didn't happen. It's okay. but that didn't happen for whatever reason. I think my last five schools, I had Wisconsin, South Florida, UNC Charlotte, Marquette, and I had Akron as my fifth because actually my high school coach, Greg Crayley, he left Chanel High School and took an assistant coaching position at the University of Akron. So, you know, out of respect for him, you know, I consider Akron in my top five schools. And to be honest, I had no intentions on going to Akron at all. But, you know, I just put them in my top five for that reason. So,
right.
So how it went, like going into my senior, I think September happened. October came. Marquette kind of fell off because Coach Crean called me. They had an in-state kid that committed, and that's Travis Diener. Who committed there. And then Wisconsin coach called me, same thing. They had an in-state Wisconsin kid, which was Devin Harris, who played in the NBA for a while. He ended up committing there. So, you know, those schools kind of just called out of respect and let me know, you know, they appreciate recruiting me and good luck and everything like that. But they told me, you know, they got their in-state guy. So it was down to South Florida, UNC Charlotte pretty much. I really like the coaching staff at South Florida, especially one of the assistant coach Zimroff. He was the one that really recruited me the heaviest out of all the staff. I really liked them. I set up my visit. I went down. I visited the school. Loved it. I loved the team. I loved the guys that were young, the freshman and sophomore guys that I knew I would be playing with. I really, really hit it off with those guys. And I think on that Sunday, when I got up, met with the coaches before I got on the plane and came back, ended up committing to South Florida.
Nice. And so did you kind of know, I mean, I know obviously Marquette and Wisconsin aren't Southern schools, but did going where was the warm weather at all factor in your decision? Or was it
Absolutely. I mean, especially going there and, you know, and being there and just knowing it's Florida, you know, it'll probably be, you know, fairly warm all year round. I think definitely that played a part in it, you know. And I think also one thing I will say this. Person that, you know, that worked at Warrensville High School, she was one of my teachers. Her name is Carma Coley, who's actually my high school faculty manager. She helps me with in our athletic department to this day. She was one of those teachers that were on a lot of the seniors about, you know, getting away. She kind of preached, listen, if you have the opportunity to go away from school, do it. It'll help you grow up, become a man on your own, make your own decisions and things like that. So I consider that when it came to deciding on a school. And I thank her to this day, you know, for kind of putting that in my mind, because, again, if I didn't go away, I don't know what type of man I would be, you know, at this point in my life.
Was it tough to go away from a standpoint of maybe people who had watched you play when you were in high school, that they wouldn't have the same opportunities to watch you play as if you had been able to go to Cincinnati or had, you know, chosen to go to Akron or somewhere more locally? Did that impact at all? Did you think about that in terms of having people be able to come watch you play, or was that not a factor at all?
Not really. I think, you know, looking at the schedule and things, I mean, over the time, we had different games that were close to home. I think my freshman year, we played in a tournament at Robert Morris in Pittsburgh. So, you know, people got to see me play, you know, maybe not as often, but, you know, some games people did get to see me play. But that really didn't impact my decision much.
Gotcha. What was your biggest adjustment going from high school to Division I basketball? What did you find to be the most different, the most challenging part of making that transition?
I think the workouts. I mean, from day one, obviously, like I said, we didn't have the training, the workouts. If somebody pushing you through an hour workout, I didn't know what that was. So the very first workout I did, the first 10 minutes of the workout, I almost died. Literally on the court, I almost died because I never worked this hard in my life. You know what I mean? And at that moment, I said, listen, this is a whole nother level. You know what I mean? So I think nowadays, just to kind of, you know, sidetrack a bit, nowadays I think these kids are a little more prepared for that aspect of the transition. You know what I mean? Because those workouts are intense. You know, and coaches expect you to play at a certain. I understand why when you play in college, like, the intensity level is so much higher, so you have to prepare your body for that. So I think that, and I think the length was something. You know, a lot of guys are tall. The guys are long. You know, you're playing against 6'11", 7 foot, 6'9" guys and 6'3", 6'4" guards. I'm 5'10". So you playing against a 6'3", 6'4" point guard, that's an adjustment. You know what I mean? In Cleveland, you didn't have that, you know, a lot of guys were my size, maybe a little bigger, but in college, you know, you talking about guys 4 or 5 inches taller, jump a lot higher, same speed, same quickness as you. What are you going to do?
Question for me, what was the best part about playing Division I college basketball in your opinion? Like, what was your favorite part about the whole experience?
I just think being able to play against the best. I just think, you know, playing against some of the best guys. I mean, I was one of the best guys in Ohio coming out. And all of these guys I'm playing against were the best guys in Florida and Georgia and Wisconsin and Chicago and New York. And, you know, so you get to play against guys all over the country that were the best guys. And so I just think, you know, to compete at that level and to hold your own, you know, that's an accomplishment in itself.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I know that I always point to during my career is that, you know, you spend so much time as a high school player where you're the best player on the floor, and in many cases, a lot of times it's not really even close. And mm-hmm. Now you get to a college level, and like you said, everybody is at that level. And I think the challenge that it puts out there, and for guys who are successful, like you were at that level, I think it just brings out that competitive nature that we talked about earlier, where you want to be able to excel no matter what environment you're in. And then when you get challenged by other guys who have a similar talent level and similar physical tools to what you have, I think it just pushes your game to a whole nother level. Did you find that to be the case?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it. You know, like I said, playing against the guys I played against, you know, I'm in a conference where you playing against McDonald's All-Americans, you playing against potential first-round NBA draft picks, you know what I mean? So it forces you. You say, listen, if you want to compete at this level and in this conference, like, you have to bring it. My freshman year, I'm playing against Steve Logan, who's a native Cleveland guy at Cincinnati at the time, who was the two-time Conference USA Player of the Year. And this guy's a senior, and I'm playing against him twice, three times in a season. So it's like, man, this guy's an NBA player. you know, I'm playing against DeJuan Wagner, who was played for the Cavs, top 10. Yep. He's an NBA player. I'm playing against Dwayne Wade. 100
points, right?
He had 100 points in the game. Yeah. Yes. I played against Dwayne Wade. I mean, you playing against future NBA guys in college. So it's like, wow, I'm here and I'm on this stage. I'm playing in, you know, in these arenas where, you know, we watch on TV growing up, and I'm here. And it's just like, you know, if I want to be successful and I want my name to be known, I have to put the work in. And I have to be ready and not afraid to go out here and do what I'm supposed to do.
So who was the best guy that you played against at South Florida? Not the guy who ended up with the best NBA career, but when you stepped on the floor against that guy while you were playing college, who, in your opinion, was the best guy that you played against at the moment you played against him?
Ooh, that's tough. That's tough. I mean, the reason I say it's tough because, I mean, you know, I've played against some very good players that were, you know, very good in college. So it's hard to just name one, but to name a few,
okay.
especially point guards. Obviously, Steve Logan, he was very good. Travis Deaner was very good at Marquette. I actually played against, he played at Fordham. What's the guy? He played for, I think, the Cavs for a second. Played for the Lakers.
Shmush Parker.
Shmush Parker. Listen, watching him play in person, he was good.
He was long. He had long arms. He was athletic.
Very long. Yep, about 6'5". Guard. I mean, he was very good. Who else? Actually, what was his name? Washington. Played at Memphis. Darius Washington.
Okay.
When I tell you, like, he was a tough guard, he was younger than me, but he was a McDonald's All-American, about 6 foot, but he was kind of stocky and fast. Like, he was very, very good. I'm actually surprised, like, you know, he kind of didn't get a little more time in the NBA. You know, I don't know what happened really with him, but he was very good. Who else? Francisco Garcia. I mean, he was a pro player. He was very good at Louisville. I mean, so it's a lot of guys. Like, it's hard to, like, pick one.
Right.
You know, because these guys were very good. But one person I can say, and I've told this story to some of my friends, one of the toughest players to play against in our conference was a guy named Squeaky Johnson. And Squeaky Johnson was about 5'9", and he could guard the ball better than I think anybody I've ever played against in life. Like, in life. I mean, he was such a great on-the-ball defender. He was on that UAB team that went to, I think, the Sweet 16 in, like, 2004, 2005. But he was pretty much this – he sparked the entire defense because they played – I think Mike Anderson was the coach, that 40 minutes of hell basketball.
From Arkansas, yep.
There you go. So yep. he implemented that at UAB, and he was the person that started it all off in the front because – again, his lateral quickness and tenacity on the ball was just second to none. So he was probably one of the guys I remember playing against, like, oh, my God, I got to play against him tonight. And I got to keep the ball, you know, take care of the basketball. It's
right,
tough.
Exactly. I think those guys are some of the toughest guys to handle. I know I used to hate when guys that were those little guys that were 5'9", 5'10", that were just quick and they, you know, they get underneath you and, you know, be in there trying to
take
the ball from you. I always found those guys to be the difficult guys to play against. So I could definitely relate to Squeaky.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had a pretty good professional career. I did a little research. He had a pretty good professional career.
Yeah, I noticed too. I didn't know, like, I think he did a little bit of time. He played in the NBA a little bit. I'm sure he probably got some playing overseas a little bit.
He played for the Hornets in 2011, 2012, but he got a lot of D-League action.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, he was one of those guys. You would love him on your team.
Yeah, it sounds like it for sure. So at what point in your career did you start to think that, you know, let's say this, if you go back to high school, obviously we all had aspirations of being able to make it to the NBA and play professionally. Mm-hmm. At what point did you kind of start to recognize where you thought you might fit in terms of being able to have a professional career?
Honestly, to be frankly honest, obviously, like I said, going in high school and things like that, I wanted to go to the NBA. As my college career kind of unfolded and things, like, my aspirations to go to the NBA, you know, kind of succeeded a little bit. I really didn't, you know, have that same ambition probably going into my, you know, junior year or so, you know, for different reasons. But, and I actually, when I said I really didn't, you know, want to play in the NBA, I really didn't have aspirations to play in Europe or over anywhere, you know, outside of the country either. It took for me to graduate college, come home, and just start playing in men's leagues around the area for people to, you know, what's going on, Swift? What you about to do? You going to try to go overseas and everything like that? And I'm like, no, I'm just going to start training. I want to just start helping the kids, like I mentioned earlier. Everybody in the city, almost in Cleveland, thought I was the craziest person in the world. And I said, what? And so it was almost like peer pressure pushed me to play professionally. You know, because like I said, I didn't really, you know, have aspirations to do it. But I knew I could possibly play. I just didn't really have the ambition. But once everybody kind of told me, and it felt good because I got the idea that, you know, everybody still had a respect for me and my game and my potential, you know, and talents. So I said, you know what? Okay, everybody said I should do it. I'm going to go ahead and pursue it. So one of my best friends, Juby Johnson, you know, I kind of trained with him, you know, the summer after his first year playing overseas. And, you know, him and Ashley Sonny, you know, they kind of motivated me to, you know, work out, pursue my career, and go on from there. So, but I attest a lot of it to, like, a lot of local guys in Cleveland that pushed me to play.
So once you decided that, hey, I'm going to try to pursue it, then what was the process? Did you hire an agent? How did you make your connections to be able to get over there?
Well, actually, a few guys actually helped out with the hiring of an agent, a guy named Roger Bond, who works now with Slam Magazine. He helped me a lot. Jonathan Givony, actually, who's like an NBA draft guy now, who had Draft Express at the time. I think he still has it now. He's a part of it now. Helped a lot just establishing a relationship with those guys. They helped connect me with an agent, my first agent. I had a few different agents, but those guys helped me connect with agents initially. So, you know, shout out to those guys helping me get started.
Absolutely. So then you end up in France. Was your first place you played?
Yep. So because it was kind of late in the process, I went to France late. I got signed a little late. It was about the 6th-7th game in the season, about October. I got signed, played for a team. It was called Antibes, which is in the south of France. So that was my first experience being in the south of France. Yep.
So I'm going to assume that you don't speak French.
I do not.
All right. So then what was that experience like? You go over there, you're a young kid, you're in a foreign country, you don't speak the language, all of a sudden you're thrown on this team. What's that first experience like? Not just from a basketball standpoint, but from a cultural standpoint, being over there by yourself in a new environment. What was that like?
I'm glad you asked. So when I got off the plane, our general manager of the team was actually Yugoslavian, but he lived in France. He spoke French. He didn't speak a word of English. So at the time, again, I came on a Friday, and the team was at an away game, and they weren't coming back till Saturday. So again, this guy didn't speak a lick of English. I got off the plane. He had my sign up, so he knew my name. We really couldn't communicate in the car from the hotel. He took me to a grocery store first to get like a passport type pictures, because you have to register for the league once you get to Europe. You have to register for whatever league that you get in before you able to play. They have to give you like a license to play. So we went to the grocery store, took the pics. You know, we're driving back. He took me to my apartment. In my apartment, it's pretty much at the time like a dorm room. I have no TV. I have no phone. I have nothing. So he pretty much just left me there. And at that time, I felt like I was the only person in the world. I wanted to cry. I couldn't communicate with nobody from home. I couldn't watch anything. And I just was in my apartment doing nothing, looking at the sky. And it was a very scary moment, you know, for me. Just to, you know, to get there and not be able to communicate, not be able to say anything, not to be able to watch or do anything with anybody. You know, it was scary. But the next day it was okay. The team came back, a couple of the American guys I got acquainted with, you know, pretty quickly. They lived in the same building, so I kind of started hanging around those guys. But that first night was tough.
Yeah, I believe it. That sounds, I mean, again, I think sometimes we forget, especially now that we're you know, we're a little bit further into adulthood. You forget what that's like as a kid to kind of be thrown into that kind of environment and you know, be somewhere where, hey, I can't communicate. I don't know what's going on. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what the situation is.
And I think it would definitely be different nowadays, right, because of, like, cell phones. Like, even having a cell phone on you at the time probably would have made it a little bit more manageable and, like, doable. Yeah. But back then, that really wasn't, like, commonplace at that point.
Not at all. I mean, I think, like, then I still had a calling card. I don't even know if they still sell calling cards right now, but I had a call. I got a calling card, and I think the next day, I ended up calling home, called my mom, told them I had made it, everything was fine, you know what I mean, things like that. But yeah, exactly. See, I had a sidekick. I don't know if, you know, you guys remember the T-Mobile sidekick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I had that. I had that. But again, how the international things work. And I ended up paying like a $600 bill one time and didn't even realize, like, well, and I had to call T-Mobile, like, what are y'all doing? Are y'all charging me? And I'm not even using it. Well, it's still buffering, still doing this. You basically have to cut it off. Well, y'all didn't tell me that beforehand. But so I learned my lesson in that manner, and it cost me $600.
There you go. You learn an expensive lesson, unfortunately.
Fast, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So talk a little bit about the basketball playing experience during the time while you were there. How would you compare the level of basketball that you were playing at compared to, like, what you played at South Florida? And just talk a little bit about what the playing experience was like.
It was good. I think it's similar to college a little bit. I think just the style of play. It's similar to college. I think the difference is you're playing with grown men, so the IQ of the game is obviously the higher than, you know, what you playing in college. But the athleticism is there. I mean, like I said, you playing against a grown guy. You might be playing against some 30-year-olds, 35-year-olds, and things like that. So that's the difference. But I would compare it to playing at the college level, like playing at South Florida, but just, you know, at a higher mental level. And then, you know, because the shot clock is a lot less, going from 35 seconds to 24 seconds, it's a little different, you know, but it was fun, though, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think anybody who gets an opportunity to do that when they're young, I think that's obviously the time to get over there and experience it. And you get that culture shock, but you also get, you know, an experience that you're never going to be able to duplicate living in a foreign country. And just, I'm sure, you know, that you would probably agree that you grew up a lot and you matured and just had an experience that, again, most people don't get to have that kind of experience.
Absolutely. And it opens your mind. You know what I mean? It opens your mind. You experience different cultures. You kind of get an idea of how people in different parts of the world view the world and think and you know, and things like that. So, you know, I think a lot of those experiences of playing in Europe and doing that type of stuff and living in Florida, you know, and now being in Cleveland, you know, I think it helps me now in my coaching because I have a totally different perspective on a lot of things.
So let's, before we jump, that was almost a perfect segue, but I don't want to miss out on this question, which is my favorite one. So give me your craziest European basketball story, whether it's fans getting paid, some crazy coach yelling at you in a foreign language, some teammate, something that happened to you while you're in the country. What's your craziest story? I know you have one.
Honestly, nothing too crazy, but
Brian,
this was
come on, man.
I'm honest. I'm gonna be honest with you. Like me, I'm a very, very laid back guy. I'm not crazy. I don't really do a lot of crazy things. So it's not too crazy. It's just kind of funny. I guess it was funny to me at the time. It was crazy at the time, but I guess I can laugh a little bit now. I might not be that crazy. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No, man, I'm ready. I'm ready for it. I'm ready to hear.
So again, I was driving to Nice. My first year in France, I was driving to Nice, France. So they had these sandwiches called kebabs. It's real popular in France. A lot of Turkish people, they have, you know, little shops and they sell these sandwiches. It almost reminds you of like a gyro, if you will, like type thing. It's like a wrap. So I was going to Nice to get it. I was on my way back, and I guess I was speeding. So I think I got clocked, and they have a lot of like, I guess those clocks. I mean, not the clock, but the cameras.
Okay.
That clock your speed over there. So, and you kind of have an idea where they are because they give you a little sign before you get to it. But I still wasn't familiar. So I got clocked pretty much by two cameras. Well, I actually got stopped by the police, and he gave me a ticket or whatever. So after being stopped by the police, I go off, I drive. And I guess how that works, the tickets get sent to the club, because the car that they got me and I was driving was basically owned by the club, right, that, you know, I played for or whatever. So they send the tickets to the club. So what ended up happening was I end up maybe a week or two later, the club called me into the office or whatever, talk about the ticket. I got a ticket, but it was two tickets. So I basically got clocked. I got stopped by the police. Or no, actually, I got clocked by one camera, and probably I'm talking maybe 30 feet ahead, I get clocked by another one, but they send two tickets.
So they're double dipping on you.
Exactly, they double dipping. Like, how you guys double dip on the same ticket? Like, you know what I mean? I'm on the same road 10 seconds later, and I get a second ticket. That makes no sense. You know what I mean? So again, it wasn't a crazy story. It was a funny thing, but again, like, it was just one of my experiences that it was like, that doesn't happen here.
No, that's
in America,
not.
You know what I mean? Where you get cited for two things in 30 seconds.
You probably couldn't do much negotiating with the police officer either, in a different language, I'm sure. Probably didn't.
I couldn't at all. He spoke English. He spoke a little English, but yeah, it wasn't really much I could do. It wasn't really much I could do.
So let's transition.
So I'm sorry to disappoint.
I'm actually impressed that you had a police officer. I've been overseas a lot, and my aunt and uncle live in England, and like, we could drive hours without ever seeing a police officer there. They're all about those clocks, though.
Wow.
And the cameras.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So let's take, Brian, all the totality of your playing experiences, and now let's parlay it into what you're doing now, which is your coaching career. So talk a little bit about A, how you got into coaching, and B, if you kind of always knew you were going to end up as a coach, or is it something that kind of you just fell into?
Yeah, I fell into it. Like I said, 2005, when I came home, I started my training company, Truth Basketball. That was my goal. That was my vision for myself, to have my own company, help as many kids as I possibly could in Northeast Ohio. But one thing that I noticed was that I had a tough time having a consistent facility to train.
For sure.
So I trained in different places, different locations and things like that. And the two people that really talked me into trying to coach were Mr. William Johnson, who's actually Sonny Johnson's dad, and Melvin Burke, who's the East Tech girls basketball coach currently, who actually coached me as I was growing up as well. So those two guys, we were at Lifetime Fitness in Beachwood. We were just talking, and you know, I was talking about training and talking about not having a facility and things like that. And they said, well, sure, you need to go coach. You need to go back to Warrensville and coach and do this, that, and the other. And if you coach there, you have a gym. So the light bulb went off. And I said, That's a good point. So at the time, Phil Stevens was our athletic director. I think you may know Phil from being in Richmond Heights.
Phil's at Richmond now.
So he actually was the athletic director still at Warrensville. He gave me, and you know, I went, sat down and talked to him. I said, listen, you know, if the basketball position is open, I would want to be considered for it. He was ecstatic. I interviewed for the job. I got the job, and the rest is history, pretty much.
So when you get the job, what's the first thing that you start thinking about as you go into your first season? What are you thinking about? Basketball stuff? Are you thinking culture stuff? Or are you just kind of thinking, man, I'm not sure what I'm going to do here?
At first, yeah. I mean, you know, at first I'm thinking, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And I had an idea just from playing and how I played the game. You know, I was pretty much a coach on the floor. So people could have forced, you know, had the foresight, like, yeah, I can see him coaching in the future. Even though in my mind, I really didn't have the thought of coaching. You know what I mean? I really didn't, you know,
Other people might have seen it.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So, but doing it, you know, I what I did first was I hired some people who had done it for a while. You know, so I hired a few of my former coaches, one of them being Tony Brown. He coached me for my AU team. At the time, Cleveland Basketball Club. Now it's Ohio Basketball Club under Mike Duncan. I called him. He was one of my first hires. I called my assistant coach from Chanel, Paul Martin. He was my next, and I actually called one of my good friends, Dominic Mann, who he's currently still on my staff as well. He's alumni. He graduated from Warrensville as well. So those are the guys I kind of called. So I kind of built my staff you know, initially before kind of even thinking about what I wanted to do. But those guys kind of helped me structure how I wanted to do things, and you know, we made it happen.
How important is having a good staff? Because I know we've talked about with some of the other coaches that we've had on how critical it is to have guys that you can trust as a part of your staff, and trust from a standpoint of, one, you trust the fact that they can run a drill at the other end of the floor, but bigger than that, that you know that they have your best interest at heart. They know that they have your program's best interest at heart and your kids' best interest at heart. How important is the guys you have as a part of your staff, both back when you first started and today? How important is that staff to what you want to do?
It's very important. I mean, it's very important because for me, and trust is big. And I think the people that you have around you have to have a similar vision as you. And I think they have to have that full buy-in to what you're trying to do as a head coach. So I think that's the most important part of coaching. I think, you know, you're only successful, I think, as the people that you have around you. You know, so if you have a good group around you and those guys buy in and believe in what you're trying to do, I think anybody can be successful.
So when you talk about what you and your staff are doing at Warrensville, what are some of the things that you try to bring to the culture of your program, that you try to get across to the kids that you coach and to your team and to your total program? What are the things that you really want to instill from a culture standpoint in your program?
I think helping them understand, like, the big picture. I mean, one thing I try to help them understand, like, this, the game of basketball, this is just a small piece of the pie. This is just a small piece of the big picture. And, you know, like I said, me as a basketball coach, I try to use the game to teach these guys about life after the game. And for most of them, life once high school is done, because most of them won't end up playing in college or beyond. So I just try to utilize basketball to help teach these kids about life.
So how do you go about doing that? Is it mostly through just talking with them, side conversations, you know, before and after practice? Is it big group talks about, you know, do you formalize what you're doing in terms of trying to teach them about life in general? Or is it just something that kind of happens organically throughout the time that you're with those kids?
I think it's a combination. I think sometimes, you know, we sit down to talk as a group. I think sometimes, you know, I may have guys one-on-one or a couple guys in my office where I could just talk to them, you know, and give them my experience. I think when you open up and give guys, you know, a lesson on you as a coach and you as a person and where you've come from, I think they can have a better appreciation of what you're telling them and where the direction you're trying to send them in. So I think it's a combination of a lot of things. And then also bringing in other people, you know, other successful people who may not play basketball but have life experiences that maybe, you know, some of those values that they use now they got from playing sports.
So what's an example of somebody that you might bring in? So do you bring somebody into practice? You bring somebody in like in the preseason to just somebody successful from the community, somebody that maybe the kids are familiar with or aren't familiar with that get a chance to talk to some of your players? Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I bring guys into practice. Sometimes it might be guys that come to our basketball games, may speak to guys after the game in the locker room, after a win or loss, and just kind of, you know, give their take on the game and also just some of the things that I've shared with them, you know, before that moment. So they may kind of speak on that. So sometimes it's impromptu. Like, you know, I may have a preseason meeting where I might bring a guy in to talk. And I think one guy I brought in numerous times is one of my good friends, Bam Childress. You know, the success he's had being an athlete, you know, and even now, you know, after sports are done, I think those type of experiences, those type of people coming in and talking to kids is important.
How much do you get a chance to have Brad Sellers involved in your program at all?
Oh, a lot. I mean, he helps a lot. I mean, he helps a lot with our youth program. He comes. We have a Brad Sellers night every year where a lot of our alumni come out to the game. He's at the games. He supports us during the tournaments. He comes to a lot of our, you know, just different sports, you know, that he comes to, he supports. So, but obviously him being a former, you know, basketball player, he definitely comes to our and supports our boys basketball game. I haven't really gotten him to come in and speak to the team, obviously with his schedule, him being mayor of Warrensville. So that's a little tough, but whenever he gets an opportunity to come support, he does.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, I think anytime you could take advantage and tap into, especially somebody like him, and, you know, I'm sure there are other people that have come through the program, have come through the school, that you can point to and say, look, here's some people that have had success, and if you can emulate and learn from, you know, the people that have had success out there in the world, I think you're doing your kids a great service to be able to show them multiple paths for how they can be successful beyond, you know, beyond the game of basketball. Because, you know, sometimes you get so caught up as a high school kid in how important the game of basketball is, that it's important. And I think it's even more important today than it was back in the time where you were playing or I were playing, where to point out, and I think coaches were more aware of the fact that we need to impact kids beyond just the basketball court.
Absolutely. I mean, because, you know, I think even just keeping it at Warrensville, the way I grew up when I coming through Warrensville, it's not the same as a lot of these kids now coming through Warrensville. I mean, it's a different community than it was when I was growing up. So me understanding those things and me having experiences with friends who when I was growing up didn't grow up like I did either. They may had a only live with mom or live with grandparents, and, you know, maybe didn't have some of the same opportunities that I may have had. So just having those relationships and understanding where they may have come from and listening to them, that kind of helped me now understand some of the kids and their experiences off the court, or those experiences outside of school. And I think you can reach a kid when you really fully understand some of the things that they deal with.
Yeah, I think building that relationship and that trust between a coach and a player is so important. And I think it's something that coaches today are probably better at than coaches used to be in the past. I think there's more of an emphasis, again, especially with, like you mentioned earlier, the amount of information that's out there and the myriad of ways we have to be able to learn from other coaches. I think just makes all of us aware of different ways that we can have an impact on our kids beyond just basketball. So if you think about yourself now in your situation, who are some of the people that you look to as mentors when you come across a situation that maybe is something you're like, I'm not sure quite how to handle this situation? Who are some of the people that you reach out to in those kinds of situations? I know you've already mentioned a few of people that have helped you get into coaching, and I'm sure there's still people on your list, but is there anybody that you reach out to when things get tough in your current situation?
Honestly, like my coaches. Obviously, like I said, I got a few coaches that are older than me, have a lot more experience than me, and that, and, you know, in those aspects. So, like Tony Brown, he's one. He's been around a long time. Also, one of my good friends, Eric Rush, who's the dad of one of my actual players now, Brandon Rush. You know, me and him are very good friends. I reach out to him. He's had a lot of experience just being a dad, you know, and this, you know, dealing with kids. He's a coach as well at the youth level, so I reach out to him as well. And also, I like to bounce things off of other coaches, you know, in the area. I talk to, you know, Sonny Johnson over at Garfield. Actually, I talk to Babe Kwasniak a lot. We text a lot. We talk about different things. And another person I talk with, Phil Smook at Twinsburg. You know, we bounce off things, you know, pretty often, you know, bounce things off of each other, you know, because we sometimes, you know, when he was at Maple Heights and even Twinsburg, you know, you deal with different situations. So, you know, just kind of listening to people and how they've dealt with it, you know, you kind of implement, you know, the way you want to, but, you know, you take from every person that you talk to, because like I said, a lot of us are dealing with the same types of situations, similar kids and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think is great about the era that we're in now, is I think coaching is a lot less secretive than it used to be, for lack of a better term. And I think there's much better communication between high school coaches nowadays than there used to be, again, 20 or 30 years ago, where I think, you know, a coach was kind of, you were in your own program, and, you know, maybe you sent somebody a VHS tape every once in a while.
Right, right.
But now, you know, guys, it's great that I think from talking to lots of different coaches, we see that people have relationships, even with rival coaches that you play two or three times in a season, still those coaches talk. You know, obviously they're not talking X's and O's, but they're still talking about just the process of how you go through. And I think that's got to be tremendously helpful to anybody in your position.
Absolutely. I mean, because we can all relate. As much as we compete with each other and we want to win, which we all do, but we can relate to each other. So I think at the end of the day, through competition, you know, that's the one thing that kind of brings us together. But we can relate with the kids, and we all want to try to help our kids be successful. So I think those experiences that we all have, sharing them with each other, helps each other. You know what I mean? It helps all of us.
Talk a little bit about, you're also the AD at Warrensville.
Yes, sir.
And how long, were you the AD immediately at the same time you were the basketball coach, or did you take over the AD job after you had already been the basketball coach?
Yes, I actually was the coach for 3 years before I actually became the athletic director. And it's funny, if you listen to this podcast over, you'll hear me say a lot of things that come into my life I didn't have plans of doing. You know what I mean? It's just the story of my life. So all these things, but opportunity always tends to come my way, and I try to take advantage of the opportunities that are given to me. So, you know, after my third year, our athletic director at the time, she had went out on some health issues or whatever, so she went out on leave, and so they pretty much hired me as the interim athletic director, and probably about midway point the school year, I think she ended up resigning, and I actually interviewed for the full-time position, and I ended up getting the job. Now, I was actually titled the athletic coordinator because at the time I didn't have my master's degree. So when they told me that, I actually enrolled at Ohio University in their master's in athletic administration program, and I did that two-year program, and I got my master's now. So I've officially since last year became the athletic director instead of athletic coordinator.
Gotcha. So what are some of the what are some of the challenges of being the athletic director at a high school?
Time commitment. I think that's the main thing. I mean, the time commitment. I love the job. I love that I can impact not only just boys basketball, but I can have an impact on all the sports in the school, and I can kind of connect with more athletes because I want to help as many kids as I possibly can, which was my goal just coming out of college. So I think that's the main thing. But the time commitment, that's pretty tough. I think sometimes, you know, dealing with certain coaches, you know, every coach wants certain things. They want their program to do well, and they want certain things. But sometimes, you know, you can't give it to them as athletic director. You know, you have certain people you have to answer to. You have certain budgets you have to stay within and things like that. So I think that gets a little tough because I try my best to, you know, make sure everybody has the things they need. But sometimes, you know, you just can't do it.
For sure. Do you do any training with any coach training with the coaches or any official programs or ways that you deal with to help your coaches to become better coaches?
I do. I try to send my coaches to, you know, professional development, to some coaches clinics and things like that every year. I try to, you know, send my coaches different emails of interesting quotes and things that can help them in their day-to-day dealings with their student athletes and things like that. Actually, I remember a few years ago, I actually had like a coaches clinic, like especially basketball, with my high school and middle school boys and girls coaches, just to kind of help them, you know, explain how we do things in boys basketball and some of the terminology we use and how, you know, we can get kids to understand what we want them to do and them go out there and execute it. So those are a few of the things that I try to do.
Yeah, I think that's very important what you just said there. Is I think a lot of high school coaches are doing that. I think if you're a high school coach out there and you're not doing that, like Brian described, having a clinic for your, you know, for your middle school coaches, for your youth coaches, to get them familiar with the systems and the terminology, and not that they have to run everything that the high school varsity is running, but certainly you want them to be familiar with some of the things that you're doing and some of the terminology and some of the ways that you go about doing, you know, instilling your culture. That only can build a stronger program from way down in the youth level all the way up to the varsity. So I think that's a great thing for any coach to take away from you just what you just said. I want to hit on one final topic, Brian, before we wrap up, and that is one of the things that I know coaches always find to be challenging is parents. So if you could give a parent of a high school basketball player any piece of advice about how they could make the high school experience better for their athlete and also for themselves, what are some pieces of advice you would give to parents in terms of how they deal with a coaching staff and their players?
I think first off, everyone has to be honest. I think as a parent, you have to be honest with yourself. Because some parents have, obviously, you know, you have an emotional attachment with your kid. So us all, no, I can't say all, a lot of parents, you know, we believe our kids are this good or that good. And we believe, you know, that they should be given a certain amount of opportunities and different things like that, you know. And sometimes parents come to certain games, they wonder, well, why isn't my kid playing? He's at practice, he's doing this, he's doing that. But it might be some things at practice he's not understanding. He may be a little late to practice. He may not be listening well. He may has not fully bought in to the process that the coach, you know, is implementing. And sometimes, yes, and I explained to some of my kids, you're not always going to have the greatest coach, but at the time, that's the coach. And you have to listen to what the coach is saying, even if the coach might be wrong at that moment in time. But I think the main thing, like I said, at the advice I think I give to parents, just be honest. I think, you know, tell your kid, listen, do your best, listen to the coach, do exactly what is told of you, and let the chips fall where they may. That's pretty much the best advice I can give. And I can be honest, like, since I've been coaching, I'm lucky, I haven't had many problems with parents in my coaching career. I think my parents have been phenomenal in Warrensville. They've been very supportive in what we've been trying to do, what we've implemented, and they've seen some of the success of that. They've seen some of our kids go on and play. They've seen some of our kids have success in the high school level. They've seen kids get highlights and get in the paper and get online and get exposure and things like that come up for our program. So they see it works. So they just, all I ask for parents to do is just, like, for in the words of my man Chet Mason, trust the process. That's all you can do.
I like two things that you said there. One, I think by being honest with both the players that you're coaching and also with their parents, I think that helps you to build a rapport with the entire family, so that if there is a situation that arises, because you've already had those truthful discussions with the player and with the parent, it puts you in a much better position if there is a conflict, that you can deal with those people. So I hear that, you know, what you're saying. And then I think the second thing that I pull out there is, if you're encouraging the kids and the parents to, you know, have respect for the coach and to do what the coach is saying, and I think you made a great point in that you don't always have to agree with the coach. This is one of the things I try to get across to my own children, is you may not always agree with everything that your coach is saying, but in the moment, you need to nod your head and do what that coach is asking you to do, because, again, that coach ultimately is determining your playing time, determining your position on the floor. And if that's what they want, then that's what you need to do in order to make those things happen. I think that's great advice for any player, parent. If we could get that across to people, I think we'd all have the kind of smooth parent relationships that you're talking about.
Absolutely agree. And I think, honestly, just being transparent, you know, us as coaches, you know, we required to have parent meetings every year before the season. And what I try to do in my parent meetings, I say, listen, this is not an equal opportunity program, especially at the varsity level. Like, I don't give anything to any of my players. Everything they get, they earn it. So if you transparent with these parents up front, I don't think they really have a leg to stand on, unless you go against what you said in the beginning. And if, can I open my practices to parents? If you want to come and watch practice every day and see what I see, you are more than welcome. And I think if you do that, parents are become a little more comfortable with what you're saying, and I think they buy in a little bit more to what you're saying.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. Brian, this has been great. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on tonight that you'd like to share with our audience, or something that you want to talk about that we haven't had a chance to hit on?
I think we hit on a lot. I think we hit on a whole lot. I think one thing, like I said, social media, we really didn't talk about that. We don't have to go into depth with that. I think the social media thing, which is so new.
Yep.
I think a lot of us, because I see it with a lot of us coaches, you know, I consider myself an old guy now, I guess, you know. Yep. So a lot of us old guys, you know, this is so new to us, and social media and how our kids utilize it. I think we just need to become more informed with it and kind of train our kids and coaches on, you know, what to expect from that and how to properly use it without damaging, you know, our reputation as a program and your reputation as an athlete.
And I would imagine that's an important role that you have as an AD, too, that's something that you have to constantly make not only the student athletes aware of, but I'm sure you're talking about that with your coaches of, hey, we need to educate kids about what it is that they should and shouldn't be doing on social media. Because, I mean, I'm sure that there's been numerous instances of a kid who's being recruited or a kid who's going to have an opportunity and suddenly somebody's going and checking their social media and they're finding things on there that makes it a red flag. And now all of a sudden somebody who was being recruited or was having an opportunity is losing that opportunity because of something they did in 30 seconds or they just didn't think about it. So do you guys have a formal process for educating kids about social media, or is it more of just a, you know, kind of a informal basis that coaches go through?
Yeah, mostly informal. And I think a lot of it, you know, we kind of, you know, had a few instances in the last few years where social media was used and improperly kids were, you know, had situations where they were, you know, suspended from school for a few days from things that seemed innocent to them. Right. But in actuality, you know, in our code of conduct, it's against the rules. So you can't do it. So, you know, so just little things like that. And it wasn't, you know, nothing, you know, to call home about, oh my God, this kid did this. He's a terrible kid. But it's just getting them to understand fully, like, listen, you guys record everything. You record, you basically tell on yourselves. You make it easy for anybody to, you know, discipline you. You know what I mean? So just utilize it in a better light and not negatively.
For sure. Brian, thanks for bringing that up. I think that was a great point that any coach out there, any parent, any player that's listening can take that advice that you just gave about being careful on social media and use that to help make themselves a better person. Before we get out of here, is there a way for people to get in touch with you, whether it's email or social media? How can people reach out to you if they just want to say hello or maybe they have a question for you after listening to the podcast?
Yes, you can reach me on Twitter at Brian_Swift216. I'm on there a lot. You can actually go to WarrensvilleTigers.org if you want to check out our schedules, check out what's going on at Warrensville. Actually, my Instagram, I'm not on there currently, but I'll be back soon. Sweezy3 on there, that's my nickname. again, just hit me up, say hello, come to a game, support us, support the Warrensville Tigers. That's pretty much it.
Brian, this has been awesome. We appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.